Welcome to Anne Boleyn's 1535 Progress, episode 7. I'm here with Sarah Morris from the Tudor Travel Guide. I'm Vanessa Cain-Tate from Secret London Runs. And we're calling this episode The Aftermath, aren't we, Sarah?
We certainly are.
The progress is finished and we're talking about what happened next. So over to you, Sarah. We've got Henry and Anne fresh off the progress. What happened in the aftermath?
You would think, wouldn't you? Okay, progress is done. That's it. There's nothing more to see here. You can all step away. But of course, we know that that last summer, 1535, would be Anne's last summer on Earth and obviously, therefore, the last progress she would ever undertake. So we can look back at that with a degree of poignancy now. Who knows where Anne Boleyn was emotionally at that time? We know there had been disappointments. She'd failed to give Henry the son and heir. But look, they'd had a great time on Progress. And we know, because we've talked about this on a couple of occasions, that the king and queen were merry in Hampshire and that they tarried longer than they thought they might do. They were having such a wonderful time. And of course, we now know that a degree of intimacy was struck up between Henry and Anne. Because probably, I would imagine, sometime around Christmas time, Anne must have realised that she was pregnant, perhaps even a little bit before that. Now, fatefully, we know, of course, that Anne would lose that child. Chapuis, Ambassador Chapuis, called that child Anne's saviour. Again, maybe that's a little bit looking at through the retroscope at the events that would transpire during the first part of 1536. But it was significant and it must have been a devastating blow for Anne and Henry because by all accounts, it was a male child.
Gosh. And do we know about when this child was conceived?
Well, yeah, we do actually, because there's two accounts that talk to us about Anne's miscarriage. The first is a contemporary letter from Eustace Chapuis, which was written to his master, Charles V, on the 10th of February. And he specifically states that it looked to be a male fetus around 3.5 months of gestation. And then later, we have Charles Risley writing his account of what happened. He also notes a male child, again, around 3.5 months. Although I think Anne Boleyn at some point was noted to have said that she herself thought that she was around 15 weeks into her gestation. But, you know, we're there or thereabouts, aren't we? And when we were, And it was interesting because when I was writing about some of the later properties that we talked about in the last podcast, and I took my shoes and socks off and started counted backwards from from the end of January, I suddenly realized that they must have been at probably either the Vine or Basing House, possibly Bram's Hill, when that child was conceived, which, you know, completely aligns with the accounts of how happy Henry and Anne seemed to have been. They'd been away, as we'd said before, from all the pressure cooker of London and all the things that we talked about that must have been heaping on the tension at the time. They'd been away, they'd been just visiting places, they'd been out hunting and hawking, they'd been wined and dined. They must have felt at times that London and all the kind of trauma and turbulence that was going on was a million miles away. Well, you know, obviously it created some great conditions for the two to reconcile themselves, if in fact their relationship had been under tension at that point.
Yeah. And so do we know, obviously miscarriages can happen for no reason at all, but do we have any clues about what might have caused it, or is there anything that was blamed for the miscarriage?
Well, certainly at the time, Eustace Chapuis talks specifically to this point. He muses on the possible causes. Now, Anne herself, we know, blamed her uncle, who she hated, the Duke of Norfolk. Not surprising, by the way, he's an odious character. But he was, he broke the news to Anne about Henry, who had fallen some sort of 5 or 6 days prior to Anne's miscarriage. He'd had a very, very nasty jousting accident in which the horse had fallen on him and he'd been unconscious for several hours. And in fact, you know, people had wondered whether he was going to survive. And Anne blamed the shock of hearing that news upon her subsequent miscarriage, although Eustace Chapuis himself just dismissed that as nonsense because he says the news was broken to her in the most kind of gentle way possible. He also suggests that some people are just saying that Anne can't carry a child to term, which of course, you know, we know she's already had one child. Of course, it was a girl, Elizabeth. And they certainly didn't understand in Tudor times that, in fact, the sex of a child was determined from sort of the male chromosomes, not the female chromosomes. So that's another story, perhaps. But then we have Mistress Somel. And Mistress Somel, of course, is Mistress Seymour. But she's called Mistress Somel in the same letter that Eustace Chapuis writes to Charles V. And he specifically notes that in January, the king had been noted as paying Jane Seymour much more attention and probably starting to shower her with gifts. And this could not have bypassed Anne's attention. Now, we know, Vanessa, there's a huge amount of debate. We talked about it in the last podcast about when did Henry's eye alight upon Jane. But we can say that by January, it certainly had. And Anne is noted to have said that, you know, she loved the king so much more than the previous queen, that she was so grief-stricken that his attention was alighting on another lady, that this also had contributed to the miscarriage.
It's an interesting tactic from Henry, isn't it? To, you know, he's been waiting for this male heir for so long, Anne's finally pregnant, and then he seemingly quite publicly starts to show Jane a lot of attention. I don't understand it. It doesn't seem rational, does it?
No, I mean, you're quite right in some ways. You would have thought that the news that Anne was pregnant just would have filled him with delight and excitement, and that no doubt he, you know, was certain that she was treated, wrapped her in cotton wool. But I'm just wondering, as you're speaking, I hadn't really thought about it before, but it is a really good point you make. But I just wonder whether, in Henry's eyes, you know, it was quite common that a king would take a mistress if his wife was unable to sleep with him. So maybe he just saw it at that point as just being one of those things I do. But, you know, what I'm really excited about is the delivery of my son and heirs. Maybe he didn't put as much attention on it. I mean, simply, we don't know. Again, we're looking back at the events, aren't we? We know what happened, what came to pass, and that eventually Henry would marry Jane. So maybe we look back in a more suspicious way, but it certainly it certainly caught Eustace Chapuis' eye. So difficult to say, isn't it? But it's a really good point you make.
No, we're so grateful for Eustace Chapuis for telling us all these amazing things about what were going on there, aren't we? So
yes.
So a couple of things might have contributed towards this miscarriage. How did Henry and Anne react to it?
I mean, I think they must have been utterly devastated. I mean, Anne must have been at her wit's end. It had not been an easy ride. And the fact that it seems that at least people of the time and herself interpreted that this was a male child. Now, in fact, even with today's kind of diagnostics, you can't definitively sex a child until 17, 18 weeks. So at sort of 15 weeks or so, we have to wonder whether they were sort of making the best guess. Difficult to say, really, at this point, whether that had been wishful thinking. But, you know, they must have been devastated. Again, Eustace Chapuis, I think, records that Henry actually was, he seems to imply that Henry was so just thoroughly over Anne at this point that he actually didn't say that much to her, just that he saw that he could never have male children with her. And that must have been really scary for Anne, because she must have sensed that the tide in their relationship, which had always been tempestuous, would turn everything hung on the delivery of this, the safe delivery of this male heir, and she'd failed again. And she must have been crushed. And you can certainly imagine at that point that Henry must have been driven, if he hadn't already been driven into the arms of Mistress Seymour, that that would be a perfectly good reason and a good time to do so.
Well, I don't think it's acceptable. But, yeah, you can understand that that could be a reason for that behaviour. But it really is so sad. And with the benefit of hindsight, we know that this was really the beginning of the end for Anne. She wasn't to live for another summer. Had anything else happened that made this more significant than some of the other tragedies that they'd suffered in childbirth?
Well, I mean, of course, what we haven't mentioned is that Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife, had died early in January. And, you know, there had been great rejoicing at court on the news of that, because Henry finally had been kind of freed from the threat of invasion and war from Catherine's Spanish relatives. And so, you know, I think there was huge amounts of optimism, and Anne must have been delighted. Well, obviously they always, I was going to use a rude word there, but you know, I was speaking from Anne's point of view, but of course, you know, they were always rivals, and for years, Catherine of Aragon had been a thorn in Anne's side and vice versa. Yeah. So no love lost there. And so Anne must have in some ways been so delighted that she was finally the undisputed Queen of England. But in kind of a bizarre twist of fate, it actually left her more vulnerable, because with Catherine out of the way, if Henry was to put Anne aside, he could take another wife. You know, it was easier for him. If Catherine had still been alive but decided to put Anne aside, he would have felt an enormous pressure, one thinks, to take Catherine back. So in some ways, in some kind of perverse sort of ways, Anne becomes more vulnerable at this point. I don't think anybody at this particular period thought that this was the beginning of the end for Anne, but of course, she was vulnerable. And I remember actually having, your instant listeners might be interested to know that when I launched my novel about Anne Boleyn, Le Temps Viendra, that I had Natalie Dormer attend my book launch. And of course,
amazing.
I know. I was just couldn't believe it. I had this book launch. We hired a boat and we took it down the Thames from Westminster down to Greenwich and back again. And she came to my book launch, and this was before she was in Game of Thrones. So she wasn't uber famous, but she had been Anne Boleyn in the Tudors, and she was my perfect Anne Boleyn. And we got talking, obviously, about some of these events around this time. And I asked her about what she thought had happened and why had Anne managed to manage the relationship with Henry so well and what had happened. And she said that she thought that Henry had lost his faith in Anne, that he never really fell out of love with her, but he lost faith in her, that she had promised to deliver a son and heir, and she had broken those promises perhaps three times, certainly two, perhaps three times, and that he just lost faith in her. And at the same time, Anne was unwell from the miscarriage and must have been emotionally so vulnerable. And she had always been so politically astute and such a force of nature, but she seems to have lost some of that political savviness, perhaps on the back of losing this child and just being crushed emotionally. And of course, she was up against the likes of Cromwell, who was just such an accomplished politician at the top of his game. And therein, with the kind of a culmination of a whole series of different events coming together, it's almost like the perfect storm happened at the beginning of 1536 that just left Anne just so vulnerable to her enemies, who must have been sitting and watching and waiting, just as they had with Wolsey, for the perfect time when Henry just seems to have turned his back on her, lost faith in her, and they knew at that point that they could go in for the kill. And of course, that is what transpired over the coming months.
Gosh, really, really tough stuff, isn't it? When you think about this vulnerable woman surrounded by enemies, it's really, really hard to think about. And what was Henry doing at this time? So Anne was recovering. What was Henry doing?
Well, actually, he left Anne at Greenwich and he headed upstream towards Westminster. Now, I know that some historians have postulated that this is another snub of Henry's, that he'd left her there and gone to Westminster. But there's also the counter argument to that, that in fact, Parliament was to open and it was called this whole Parliament from 1529, the 3rd of November 1529 through to the 14th of April 1536 was called the Reformation Parliament, because we have that whole series of acts that we've been talking about before. You know, the Act of Succession, the Act of Supremacy, which made Henry head of the church in England. And then in the spring of 1536, Parliament reconvenes, as it always did in the springtime, and it would be completely normal for Henry to move to his palace at Whitehall so that he could be near Parliament, could have a presence in Parliament. That was entirely normal. So I kind of feel that, in fact, it wasn't really a snub. It was probably the fact that Anne was just recovering and he needed to transact business. He needed to be there at the tail end of this Reformation Parliament. And on the 4th of February of that year, Parliament finally passed the Act of Suppression of the Lesser Monasteries. So all the visitations, the Valor Ecclesiasticus, which was the audit of the monasteries first, and then the visitations that we've been talking about that started during the 1535 progress, all culminated in this first Act of Suppression. This was the beginning of the end, or should I say, the end of the beginning. I don't know which way you want to look at that. But anyway, yes. You know, it was an act of Parliament, and this would see all of those smaller religious institutions, which had under 12 kind of people, monks, nuns, closed. Now, the final act, which would be the dissolution of the greater monasteries, wouldn't come until 1539, but it was on its way. So this was a really important Parliament session for Henry.
So were there lots of these smaller monasteries?
Yeah, I mean, yes, there were. I don't have the numbers at the tips of my fingers, but there were a lot of smaller religious institutions. We actually talked about one during the progress, the one at Leonard Stanley, which only had 3 monks there. So, you know, it was those kind of places that were shut down. And of course, all their goods and their wealth were heading towards the royal coffers. And I think it's certainly true to say for the Act of Suppression of the Greater Monasteries, I presume it's the same for the Lesser Monasteries, you know, monks and nuns were pensioned off, they were given a pension, but they were turned out and kind of left to get on with it. So it was really the beginning of the end of what, 400 years of monastic life in England? Mm. Such an enormous change to the religious landscape.
Yeah. So why did they just do the small ones first?
I think it was probably just easier, Vanessa. I don't know I'll put my hand up and say, I don't know the answer to that question, but I imagine they would be less contentious. And Cromwell was no doubt managing this. I mean, this was a major change, as I just said, in the sort of religious landscape of the country. And large religious institutions would have been very visible to the populace. They were, you know, they were pilgrimage sites. People's way of life were wrapped around them. They provided not only hospitality, but care for the poor and the needy. So they weren't completely at this stage breaking apart, you know, kind of a way of life that people had become accustomed to over some sort of 400 years or so. It was probably just easier just to close those smaller religious houses down without causing too many waves.
And perhaps, I guess, test the water. Learn a bit about how to do this. Almost like a prototype, isn't it, in development? Just do it on a small scale first, learn, and then replicate on a wider scale.
Well, you might think so, but I should just note that, in fact, the suppression of these smaller houses had been done before. Cardinal Wolsey had closed some smaller religious institutions. So if I'm right in saying this, again, I'm not an expert on the dissolution or the closure of monasteries, but I think he wanted to dissolve them to create some wealth so he could establish some of his colleges that he went on to establish, for example, I think in Ipswich was one of those cases. So, and in fact, You might be interested to know that Wolsey's right-hand man, who was the operations man who helped with those closures of those monasteries back in the 1520s, was none other than Thomas Cromwell. So he'd already been there, done that, and had had the template of how to close a monastery. But you never know, this might have been the refinement of these processes. And this was on a much bigger scale than Wolsey had ever set out to achieve or to even want to do.
Wow. So this really was, in the aftermath of the Reformation progress, we get some pretty big Reformation news. So Henry has been around, he's visited a lot of houses of reformists. He's started the visitation of the monasteries during the progress, and then he comes back and legislation's passed.
That's right. That's right. And we do know that within that, of course, ultimately, Henry was responsible for signing off on all of this. But we do know that in amongst that, as I was saying earlier on in the podcast, that Anne Boleyn was a strong evangelical, even in these early days. And she also wanted to see reform. I think what happened, though, was that Thomas Cromwell wanted to take those reforms further than she perhaps had envisaged. But we certainly see her, particularly in that centerpiece of the Winchester, when she had her reformist bishops placed in some of the key positions in the fledgling Church of England. She was absolutely kind of right in the heart of making that happen. So it's such an interesting progress. There is so much going on culturally, religiously, on a social level. And then we have all this drama at the end of it, where Anne Boleyn and her faction are simply swept aside by some incredible politicking from Thomas Cromwell. And perhaps I just should finish by saying that with her demise, the likes of Thomas Cranmer, who was a strong supporter of Anne and a reformist, and Dr. Butts, who was Henry VIII's physician, who was also a very committed evangelical at court, were both incredibly fearful that the cause of the Reformation would die with Anne's execution. And that just shows how important she was. And as Eric Ives said, you know, she wasn't just a catalyst in the Reformation. She was actually a key ingredient in making it happen.
Well, it's been amazing hearing about this incredible journey from Anne Boleyn. Is there anything else that you want to share about it? Any highlights, lowlights, anything else that you want to tell us about it?
So from Anne's point of view, I just really hope that in sharing this progress, people have a chance to see the woman who is not just that stereotypical whore and home wrecker, as Catholic propagandists would have liked you to believe, and certainly wrote copious amounts on after her death, but that she was a woman who had really strong, committed religious beliefs and was a key protagonist in bringing the Reformed faith and shaping the religious landscape in England for centuries to come. In fact, you know, we're still living really in the aftermath of that reform change. We are no longer connected to principally the Holy Roman Catholic Church and the Pope. You know, we have a church in England, and that began at this time, and Anne was a key component. So I hope people see that through having followed her along her progress. On a personal level, I would just like to say that the highlights for me will always be about going to visit these places. There is absolutely nothing like just packing your bag, hitting the road, taking a good book with you, and learning about the events and the people that took part in those events in the places in which they actually happened. You see things that you do not see when you simply read a book. The whole landscape becomes alive to you. And I think we have the chance to just pull back that veil of time and to touch history in a way that we just can't do when we're just reading from a book. And so my whole highlight was going to all of these places that we've been talking about throughout the whole of this progress, be it just a simple field with some earthworks in it or a fabulous sort of Tudor house. They're all equally as precious to me, and I would just encourage those people out there who've been listening to this to maybe go and visit some of them for yourselves. But in the meantime, I just want to personally say thank everybody for coming along and following this progress. I hope they've really enjoyed it and they've learned some things along the way. And it's been absolutely my pleasure to be a guide with you, Vanessa, and with Natalie alongside me. It's been epic. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. You've been absolutely amazing. And that was a beautiful answer. Now, before we go, you spoke so beautifully about your, it is work, but you love it, going and visiting Tudor places. So maybe you could tell our listeners what's to expect next from the Tudor Travel Guide.
Ooh, well, there is a big project coming up, but it's top secret at the moment, but it is going to be more. Yeah, it is. It's in its fledgling stage. I've been thinking about it for a while and I've been doing a listening exercise. I've been wide open and listening to what my followers are wanting. And as you know, the Tudor Travel Guide, it's all about learning about and inspiring people to visit Tudor locations or locations steeped in Tudor history, you know, because I believe that it's only time and not space which separates us from the past. And we get that ability to connect in such a felt way. And it's been so interesting to talk to some of those people who follow the Tudor Travel Guide. I've been amazed, actually. I don't know why I'm amazed, because I feel this myself, but so many people have talked to me about when they go and visit somewhere, it's like they feel whole again. It's like they feel like they're coming home. And so this just isn't about going to see places. For Tudor lovers, this is a really felt experience, and it's really, there's something that's deep and poignant and soulful about it. And on the back of listening to what people have been wanting to, people want from the Tudor Travel Guide, I have been incubating, shall I say, a project that actually I think might be my version of John Leyland's itinerary. Not quite like that, but I think it's going to be a labor of love that is going to take me many years to complete, but I'm hopefully going to be starting it later on this year. So can I just say that if you love visiting Tudor places, probably the very best thing you can do to be, you know, keep up to date and to hear all the latest news as it goes live is simply to go to my website, which is www.thetudortravelguide, and just make sure you subscribe, because of course I keep all my followers updated and they will be amongst the first people to know when this new project goes live and gets announced.
Well, that sounds so exciting, Sarah. And in the meantime, I thoroughly recommend Sarah's books, In the Footsteps of Anne Boleyn, In the Footsteps of the Wives of Henry VIII. And I'm afraid I haven't read your fiction work, but it sounds amazing and it's on my list. Remind me what that's called.
So Le Temps Viendra, a novel of Anne Boleyn. I use Le Temps Viendra, of course, because those are the words written by Anne herself in one of her books of hours that you can see at Hever Castle, The Time Will Come. And it is written in English, folks. I have had people say, is it in French? No, it is written in English. Have no fear. It's in two volumes, though. It's a bit of a monster. But it was my first piece of writing. It came about, actually, on the back of a visit to Hever Castle, when I was sitting on the lawn, having walked around the castle, and I allowed my mind, my imagination to stray into thinking, what would it be like just for a moment if you could go back to the 16th century and just see Anne and see the Boleyns? And in that moment, a little kernel of an idea started, and I got home and I started writing, and it was like I was taking dictation. I've never had that experience before of a story just flowing through me. It was like it was coming from another place. It was the most incredible feeling. And Le Temps Viendra will always have a very special place in my heart.
Amazing. And obviously you can keep up with Sarah through her Instagram and Facebook. So it's the Tudor Travel Guide on Instagram. And there's loads of amazing videos of Sarah at Tudor places. So I thoroughly recommend following Sarah there. If you have enjoyed this, this is one of a number of walking and running and cycling challenges that follow in the footsteps of people from history. So we've got a number of, and this is all available through Secret London Runs. So we've got a series that follows all six of Henry VIII's wives. We've got a series called The Rival, which is comparing three journeys each from Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots. And this journey is the first in a series called Fierce Women of History. So this is Anne Boleyn's progress. And I hope that by the time we launch this, we've also got another few challenges out there to keep Anne company. So thank you, Sarah, for being so quick to offer this one up. It's been amazing collaborating with you. And please do get in touch with us if you have enjoyed this series. If you want to know more about anything, we'd really love to hear from you. So thank you, everyone, for taking part, and well done for completing such an incredible distance. So thank you so much, Sarah, and well done, everybody.
Thank you, Vanessa. That's been amazing. It's been such an honour.